Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 226, and we're going to do a redo of our big solar episode from way back, because, hey, things have changed a little bit in the solar world, and, well, I've learned some things too. We're also going to talk about aftermarket hitches. Should you bolt a hitch to your van? A product review of a cleaning product that I think everyone should have, and a tale from the road involving something a little embarrassing, but not too much. We shall see. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining me here once again. And we are now going to dive into episode 226, where a cat will be bothered. Yes, you having a good time down there? Okay. I need to record the podcast now, so you need to be quiet. Yes? Yes. Oh, and everything's making noises at me. All right. Stop it. Everything be quiet. So, one of the great many things that makes van life easier now than it was in the 70s or any time before is the advent of solar. We get free power from the sky! It's not free. You have to pay for it. And it's a little bit fickle. And when I first started investigating van life, I watched some YouTubers saying basically that you won't recoup your money from solar power. It was a waste of time and you shouldn't bother with it. And I couldn't disagree more. If you are going to do boondocking, man, get some solar panels. They make such a huge difference. And it's funny to me how slow the RV community has been to catch on to this, probably because most RVs are designed to be hooked up in campgrounds. My Airstream is a 2018. It has solar panels. But those solar panels are wimpy, wimpy, wimpy for the size of that rig. The original configuration was that it came with two AGM batteries and it has 180 watts of solar on the massive 26-foot-long roof. And I've never had a rig, anything, with that wimpy specs. Okay, I've had really wimpy batteries, but never that wimpy solar. Even my NV200 had 200 watts of solar on it. So it's a different world. But I figure most van folks, most folks who are attracted to van life, don't want to hang out in campgrounds, because if that's what you want, you'd be more in the RV community. You want to go out there and be completely independent, and solar gives you that as much as anything. But things have changed, and usually for the better. Actually, everything for the better. And I thought I would go through this, and somebody in the Discord channel was a little confused about all the numbers involving solar, and I thought, you know, it's time for me to do another solar episode, because it's actually really easy. But it's very easy to get lost in all the weeds of amps and amp hours and watts and serial and parallel and ohms and all this. You don't have to know it all. I'm going to explain it all right now. I made a list. I have 10 items. I'm really liking lists lately. I don't know why. It's just how my brain's wired, so you're stuck with it. And I apologize if you do not like Arabic numerals 1 to 10. But that's what we're getting today, starting with number 1. And I want to talk to you about the workhorse of solar panels, the plain old boring 100 watt rigid solar panel. These are what I have, what I've used on most of my rigs. They're just tough as nails. I've never had one fail, except for the very first one I bought, which failed after a couple of days. It turned out it was a diode. It's really the only thing that can fail in these things. And I bought 100 diodes on Amazon and fixed it for 17 cents. That's how much it cost me. But that was weird and rare. And you won't have to do that unless you get incredibly unlucky. If you are looking to do simple solar, look at the 100-watt solar panels. And then all you have to do is figure out how many you can fit on your rig. That's it. 100-watt solar panels are basically a piece of tempered glass, and underneath the glass is a layer of foil that has basically a circuit imprinted on it and a coating, and that turns solar energy into electricity. I'm way oversimplifying here. But as far as you're concerned, that's all you need to know. And the aluminum frame that goes around that glass is, you know, about an inch deep, maybe a little bit more, but it gives you all kinds of attachment options and things like that. The rigs that I have attached the solar to personally myself, I have attached them to roof racks or made my own roof rack. Just using self-tapping screws or nuts and bolts, depending. I always use stainless steel. Nothing's ever flown off. Everything has worked fine. And honestly, solar has been one of the simplest things to do for me. What's changed with 100-watt solar panels is we no longer care about monocrystalline versus polycrystalline. There's two different manufacturing techniques. There was a time when mono was considered better and it cost more, and then poly caught up, and then they leapfrog each other and output it. Don't skip it. Don't care. Mono, poly, do not care. What I care now about is price. Now, sure, you can get a 100-watt panel that will outproduce another 100-watt panel, but the differences are so minimal that it's really not worrying about. And I have a link in the show notes for the absolute lowest price 100-watt solar panel I've ever seen. I do not own these. I can't review them personally, but they look to be exactly like my other ones are. For the record, I have Rich Solar and New Power, I think that's what it's called, panels on my rig that I've used mostly. I've never had a problem, and they're almost identical. Folks, this 100-watt panel that I found today is $56. $56 a panel. I mean, you could get 1,000 watts of panels for $560. That's amazing. The first panel I bought, I think it was $110, and then I got one for like $96, and then I got one for $89. You can see the trend here. But $56 for 100 watts of solar, I mean, that is a great, great deal. And if you've been afraid to jump into solar, you can easily have a complete solar system for under $100 now. Easily. $56 for a panel, $10 for a PWM controller, which we will get to, and then the rest is wires and stuff. Amazing. But that leads us to the next question, number two. Is it better to have a bunch of small panels or one big one? For example, should you have four 100-watt panels or one 400-watt panel? Well, like everything in van life, it's a trade-off. You have to compare expense. You might save a little bit money with the 400-watt panel, but you might not because they're much more difficult to make. Complexity, you're going to have a lot more wires with the 100-watt panels than you will with the 400-watt panels. And then you have to consider, is it easier to mount one 400-watt panel rather than four 100-watt panels? After all, you can split up the 100-watt panels and have them go around a max air fan or an antenna or whatever, but that 400-watt panel is going to be one solid piece that's going to need a completely clear space of roof. So that's your choice entirely. One other thing to think about is that if something bad happened to your solar panel, like a rock fell on it, you would want that to happen on the 100-watt panel rather than the 400-watt panel, because you could then just replace that one panel or do a field repair and bypass that one panel so the rest of it worked. So as far as a durability standpoint is considered, the four 100-watt panels are better. But again, that is a design choice. And ultimately, I think my big thesis here on solar is what comes down to is what you can fit. That's the most important thing. What can you fit on your rig? All right, let's talk about the different controllers. PWM versus MPPT. Pulse wave modulation versus MPPT. Maximum PowerPoint tracking. Which is better? Well, MPPT is better in performance. There's absolutely no question. MPPT can draw more power out of solar panels than PWM, and it has this uncanny ability to turn excess voltage into amperage, meaning that if you have a lot of volts but low amps, which is something you could have if you had a lot of panels at low sunlight, you would get more power with an MPPT controller than you would with a PWM controller. But not that much. There are drawbacks to MPPT controllers as well. They're bigger, which is something I don't hear a lot of people talking about, but I've used Renergy Rover MPPT controllers, and those things are huge. PWM controllers can be much, much smaller, and they cost a lot more. A PWM controller is $10. An MPPT controller is $80, $100, $200, depends on how fancy you go. So which should you get? Well, if you're doing a budget build, it's a no-brainer. Get the PWM. I have a PWM in my Airstream. My Airstream comes with a PWM. I have a PWM in my Tiki Bago, the 1972 Winnebago. The solar system in that was installed in 2016, so it's a little bit out of date. That's all they had back then. And I have MPPT in my Sprinter van. Honestly, at the end of the day, I can't tell the difference. They all charge the battery just fine. Now, my MPPT has fancy Bluetooth, and I can see stuff on my phone and all that, but that's just nice to have. What you're trying to do is charge your battery, and they will both do that to varying degrees of efficiency. So, if you want to go fancy, MPPT, If you want to go cheap and just get the job done, PWM. Pro tip, if you buy the $10 PWM, buy two so you have a replacement in case the first one fails. Because, heck, it's $10. Number four, math. So, like I said, a lot of people get confused by all the math in solar. There's all 8 million measurements for solar panels. If you flip over your rigid solar panel, you'll look, there's a sticker on there with open voltage and irradiance and all these crazy measurements. And you might think, oh my God, I don't know what any of this stuff means. I'm going to screw stuff up and burn my van down. Nah, you're not. Don't worry about it. Honestly, seriously, the only thing you care about number-wise, and you really don't even need to care about this, is the wattage. As a rule of thumb, you want to match the wattage on your solar panels to the amp hours of your batteries. So if you buy a 100 amp hour battery, get a 100 watt solar panel. Now, this is a very loose rule of thumb. The real answer is get as much solar as you can afford, as you can fit, as you want. Because you can't have too much. Once your batteries are filled up, your controller will turn the panels off, and that's it. On some days, you will want every last bit of solar you can. There's a huge difference between going out in June, when it's a mild day, and seeing how fast your batteries charge, versus going out in December, in Canada, on a cloudy day. It's a vast difference, and I can tell you that somebody with 1,000 watts of solar in Canada in December is barely going to be able to charge anything, whereas in the Florida sun in June, someone with 100 watts can do wonders. So that's the answer. Fit as much as you can. But if you're just trying to spec things out, you know, generally try to match them. And this brings us to a touchy issue, flexible panels. So there's two basic kinds of panels. There's the rigid panel, which is a piece of tempered glass in a frame. And then there is the flexible panel. But things have changed in the flexible panel world. Flexible panels have a terrible reputation. Their only advantage is that they're thin and a little bit flexible. They can kind of bend with the contour of your roof, but you can't fold them up or anything. You can't bend them around anything, which of course makes them terribly inefficient because there's no way that panel can ever reach peak efficiency if it's curved, because some parts are going to be perfectly aligned with the sun and some won't. Also, they break. Also, they're super sensitive to temperature, and because of the way people tend to mount them directly to the surface of the van, they get too hot, and then they fail, and that is a bad thing. They're also expensive, did I mention that? And they last about 2 years. So, yeah, flexible panels have a terrible reputation. But wait, there's more. There's a new kind of flexible panel called CIGS, C-I-G-S, and that stands for copper, indium, gallium, diselenide, which is not important at all. It's just kind of cool. These panels are much more flexible. The basic difference is that the old panels were made out of silicon crystals, and that limited the flexibility. The new ones are made out of a powder, and because of that, they're much more flexible. They last longer. They're better in every way, except for two. Yeah, those two ways are they're much more expensive, and they're actually not as efficient overall. They're a little bit more efficient when you regard temperature, but overall, you're going to get less power per square inch than you would out of the old-fashioned flexible panels, and certainly out of rigid panels. But there are cases where you might want or need these. One is that if you want it to match the curve of the roof. All right, I can understand that. That would be a good reason to use these. Another is that you're trying to be stealth. You want to hide the panels as much as possible. That makes sense too. Just remember that flexible panels, the panel itself might only be a few millimeters thick, but it's always going to have a little bit of a control nodule on it. The traditional ones have like a bar that the wires come out of, and it's an inch or more thick, so that part is still going to stick up. The CIGS panels have a much smaller one, so it's better in that regard too. But man, you're going to pay for it. I mean, you couldn't pay 3 or 4 times as much per watt for CIGS than you can for rigid. Actually, with the new pricing, it's probably even more than that. So weigh that out. You're not going to save money with flexible panels, I can tell you that. Number 6, the most controversial issue with solar panels, I think, is how to mount them. I am going to state my opinion. You may disagree with it, and that is okay. But in my opinion, all things mounted to the roof, whether they be solar panels or whatever, should have bolts or screws and not rely on adhesives. But Jeff, you say adhesives are so good now. Some of the products 3M makes are incredibly strong, and there's no way that's going to fly off. And I would say you're right. Those adhesives are amazing. But what are they adhering to? They're not adhering to the roof. They're adhering to the paint. And how well is that paint attached to the roof? We don't know. We have no way of testing that, and I have seen plenty of vehicles, usually General Motors, where the paint is just flying off the vehicle over time. Imagine if your solar panels were glued to that paint. They'd come off too. So in my opinion, even with flexible panels, they should be bolted in because you cannot trust the bond between the paint and the roof. And I know a lot of people disagree with that, and they'll tell me, well, if you do it right, it'll work forever. And I've had mine up there for 3 years. They've never blown off. Yes, I understand all that. The problem is you can't check it. I can go look at my solar panels and make sure all the bolts are in place and know that it's secure. You can never check to see if the adhesive is strong. You just can't. The only way to do that is to pull on it and loosen the adhesive. You don't want to do that. Another tip for mounting, though, is don't forget the hood. You can put a solar panel on your hood, especially a flexible one. There are products now being sold that match most trucks and vans where you can put a solar panel on the hood to charge your starter battery. And heck, that's not a bad idea either. So, hey, don't forget about that. Also, when you're mounting, consider that heat reduces the efficiency of solar panels. So you want to have an air gap between the panel and the roof. This is a problem for the flexible folks. I get that. But for the rigid folks, at least put spacers under it. You want air to flow under the panel because when they get super hot, which, you know, they're out in the sun all day, their efficiency goes down. This is a good thing in the winter, however, because you can get a little bit more power than you might think. Number 7, MC4 connectors or not? Well, all solar panels I've seen come with these connectors, MP4. Now, this is for normal solar panels, not for the ones that you bought especially for your Jackery or anything like that. They have barrel connectors or something else. And I'm just talking about the normal rigid solar panels. This is what most of them come with. MP4 connectors are waterproof. They're sunproof. They're very good connectors. But they're a little bit big. And if you were to put them in a hole in your roof and to bring them into the vehicle, you'd have to drill a fairly big hole, and people don't like that. So what can you do? Well, you don't need to use MP4 connectors. On my NV200, I simply took the cover off the box that's on the bottom of the solar panel and found terminals, screw-down terminals. So I made my own wire using 10 AWG, and sorry, British folks, you're going to have to convert that to millimeters because we're silly over here. And I put on a ring terminal, and I ran that wire, which was very thin, through a very small hole, and I didn't use the MP4 cables at all. It's fine. It's just a wire. However, if you want to use the MP4 cables, know that you can just keep finding connectors and adapters. There's all kinds of them. You can just plug them in, and you'll end up with like a coil of wire living under your solar panel on the roof. That's okay, too. Just don't think that you're stuck with those. You can actually take them apart. You can remove them. You can adapt them. You can replace them with something else. Number 8, what about portable? All right, portable panels weirdly often aren't waterproof, which is bizarre to me, and I think it's because most portable panels have a controller built into them, and the controller isn't waterproof. So honestly, if you have space, you can just use rigid panels as your portable panels. If you don't have space, yeah, you're going to have to buy one of those folding ones, and then you have to deal with whatever they have. The problem with the portable ones is you can't add them to an existing solar system easily because they have their own controller. So you have to have a separate system, and you have to make a choice. Why would you want portable instead of fixed solar panels? Well, the simplest answer is that if you do that, you can park your van in the shade, and then you can put your solar panels in the sun. That is the best way to go. Otherwise, you have to park in the sun to get your solar panels in the sun, and that's heating up your van. And if you're running air conditioning, you can see the problem here. It's like you're parked in the sun to get the power for the air conditioning, but you need the air conditioning because your van's in the sun, etc. So Portable panels are great, just know that there's some problems with them. What I have been doing is I have a couple of spare 100 watt rigid panels and I use them as portable panels, but they don't have a controller built in, so I can literally just plug them in to any of my existing systems in parallel, and it just is added to the power that's on the roof. Quick note on parallel or serial, which you will run into when you're messing with these wires. Parallel increases amperage, serial increases voltage. If you are using an MPPT controller and you have a lot of panels, you may want to wire them in series because this will increase the voltage, which the MPPT controller can then turn into amperage, and you can use thinner wires. That is a good thing. However, if there's any shade on those panels, it's going to kill your power dead. Like if a leaf falls up there, it does a lot of harm in how much power you're producing, whereas parallel is much more forgiving. You will get the most power out of an MPPT controller and a serial connection, but that doesn't mean you want to do it. A parallel connection is more flexible and requires less fancy hardware. That is a detailed topic that I'm going to leave here for now, but know that there's a reason to do one or the other. Number 9, very simple tip. Use all your power during the day. If you're going to pump up a boat or do some fancy cooking or whatever, do it during the day when the sun is shining, because this controller is only going to power your batteries until they're full. Once they're full, they're going to shut off. So use as much power as you can during the day and use as little as you can at night, and you'll end up getting the most power. Pretty obvious. And one last thing that has nothing to do with solar but always comes up in these discussions. Windmills. In short, no, they don't work for our application. To have a windmill be successful, it really needs to be about 30 feet above your vehicle, because a 10-foot windmill is not going to do much. They're very unreliable and they're very noisy. So don't waste your time doing windmills in your van. People have tried it. It hasn't worked. We are not on sailboats where there's a constant trade wind. That's a different application. On land, it's rare you can get enough speed and enough height to get your windmill to work. So if you have any specific question about solar power and you'd like me to address them, please send me a note at jeff@built2go.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And in the meantime, thank you to Michael and all you monthly contributors for helping to keep this show ad-free. There are no ads on this show, and there will be no ads on this show for the time being, because you folks have got together and bought me some diesel at buymeacoffee.com/built2go. Because of you guys, you have just heard all the ads that are going to be in this show. And now we continue with content. Van Life News! So you may have heard, you may not have heard, but Florida is in the middle of this huge fight right now because the state has decided to take a bunch of the state parks and develop them. They want to put in hotels and massive lodges and golf courses and pickleball courts and disc golf, and they gave the public an entire week to respond to this proposal without talking to anybody at all. Nobody at the parks knew about this. No one in the park management knew about this. It's a big kerfuffle. Why does this affect van life? Well, they're taking up space that we use to camp in. There's a lot of state parks in Florida, and they have a system where you can reserve a space and stuff, but that's what they're taking away. One golf course they're building 45 holes, I think. I mean, they're taking up massive amounts of land. Now, the state says that they've offset this by buying a lot more acres and such. But anyway, I'm just bringing the controversy to light to you. If you're somebody who van lives in Florida a lot, this might affect you. So I'll have a link in the show notes from WPTV that will explain it in much more detail. But yeah, there's like, as of the broadcast of this podcast, there's like 2 days left for you guys to say something, which is pretty pathetic in my opinion. And a little bit of close to home news here. I went downstairs. My building has an underground parking garage. That's where my wife parks. I go down there once in a while, and I saw a brand new Land Rover Defender. No, not the foofy new one that's all cutesy and stuff that, you know, isn't terribly rugged, but it says Defender on the back. No, I mean, like a Defender, you know, the real Defender, the one that you could cross Africa in and repair everything with just a crescent wrench. I saw a brand new one. I thought, well, they haven't made these for years. What is it? It's not a Defender. It's called an Ineos Grenadier. Ineos, I-N-E-O-S. Now, this is a project that this guy basically was sad that the traditional Defender was not going to be made anymore, and he went to the company that owns Jaguar Land Rover, which is Tata, an Indian car company, and said, hey, I know you guys aren't going to make these anymore. Let me buy all your tools and all your patents and everything, and then I will keep producing these under a separate brand. And Tata said, no, you're not doing that. So the guy was like, okay, fine. So he basically copied the vehicle. None of the same parts, all new tools, but he is making basically the same vehicle. And while they're not vans, they are a classic vehicle that you could totally build out into an amazing Overlander rig. And there's one in my garage, which means that they are real. This isn't just vaporware. So if you'd like to learn more about that and this crazy project, there's a link in the show notes. It's just the Wikipedia link for INEOS Grenadier, not to be confused with the bicycling team by the same name, which is just bizarre to me. And last piece of news here, there was a van fire in Yellowstone. Now, sadly, this is not that newsworthy because these things happen all the time. But every once in a while, I want to just pay some attention to these. Guy in a Sprinter had a built-out van. He's driving through Yellowstone, and smoke starts coming out of the hood. Oh no, what's going on? Stops, opens the hood, sees flames, grabs his fire extinguisher, and realizes that he basically has fuel dumping onto something hot. And that fuel capacity is a lot more than his fire extinguisher capacity. So he does what he can with his fire extinguisher, runs back in the van, grabs his laptop, and then stands far away and watches all his money and work completely go up in smoke, literally. It's a very sad event, but I have to congratulate the guy for doing the one thing I'm telling everybody who's building a van, and that is your first purchase should be a fire extinguisher. There's so many people out there traveling without fire extinguishers or without easy access to the fire extinguisher. Folks, you've got to have a fire extinguisher. If not for you, for someone else. In my Sprinter, as soon as you open the slider, there's a big fire extinguisher hanging there. You can reach it from the outside. It has a lot of capacity. And I think everybody should have something similar. And arguably, you should have one where you can reach it from the driver's seat as well as from the back. So this poor guy lost his rig, even though he had a fire extinguisher, but he didn't lose his life. And that's the thing you have to care about. Link in the show notes from the Livingston Enterprise for that. Tech Talk. Aftermarket hitches. Should you put an aftermarket hitch on your rig? Well, in many cases, you have to. The truth is that you go to the dealer and say, I want to put a tow hitch on my van. Half the time, they're going to look at you like you've got six heads because they don't know how to do this. And I've heard many, many stories about people being turned away from the dealers. So you end up having to do it by yourself or taking it to a hitch shop, like U-Haul. I've had a hitch put on by U-Haul. They're actually pretty professional. That is a total solution. But you can also do what I did and just buy the hitch off Amazon. I have installed three hitches now from Kurt. Kurt is not the first name in hitches, but they're solid and reliable. And I just wanted to share some things about this process. First, read the instructions before. Some of them require cutting, some of them require drilling, and this is not simple drilling. Some of these you have to drill through the frame, and those frames are very, very thick. It takes a lot of work. You need a good drill. You're not going to be doing this with a battery-powered drill in most cases. Second, and this is something I, when I installed the hitch on my Sprinter, I didn't think of, these things are heavy. Now, I installed the hitch on my Sprinter in a hurry. I had bought a tractor and I needed to tow it somewhere and I didn't have a hitch. So it's 7 o'clock in the morning, I've got the hitch, I'm under the car, in the snow, in March, and I'm pushing the thing up under there. And you know what? They're heavy. And I ended up dropping it on my face, breaking my glasses. So yeah. Make sure you are physically capable of doing this, or make sure you have help, because these things are heavy. It's going to weigh 50, 60, 75 pounds, and you basically have to hold it in place with one hand as you put in nuts and bolts with the other. Also, a lot of these require you to fish bolts through the frame using a wire with springs. It's not that hard, but in one case in the NV200, I had it get stuck and I could not get it out, and they don't give you any spare bolts, so I had to go source the right kind of bolt, and these are heavy-duty bolts. They're not just your average bolt. You might find a bolt at Home Depot that fits. It might be the right size, but that doesn't mean it's going to be strong enough, and that's very important. Lastly, if you do install your own hitch, be sure that you go back after you tow something and tighten it again. I was shocked after I towed my Scamp back from South Dakota to Illinois how loose the bolts got that I had put in. I mean, wow. If I had not paid attention to it, that hitch would have come off. And the emergency chains go to the hitch. So if the hitch comes off your vehicle, the trailer comes completely off your vehicle, that's a very bad thing. So absolutely make sure you check those bolts. And honestly, use some Loctite on there because you don't want that to happen. And now mine all have Loctite on there and I'm not so worried about it, but I still check them every once in a while. Oh, and one other thing. This is just the hitch. The wiring is a whole other thing, so make sure you can find a plug-and-play wiring solution for your trailer's lights if you need that. If you're just putting up a bike rack, you don't need that. But if you're going to tow something, worry about the wiring. And it turns out that if you have LED lights on your trailer, like all modern trailers do, you might need an actual little computer translation box to put in the wiring. It's not as simple as a one-to-one thing. So, yes, you can put your own aftermarket hitch on there. Yes, they're safe and effective. But you have to know what you're getting into. Product review. One thing we all have to do in our vans at some point is do dishes. I suppose you could have all paper plates and all wooden utensils and you throw them out or burn them or whatever, but you still have a pot or something, right? You're going to be cleaning something. Well, this is one of those problems that has 100 solutions, so it has no solution, but it kind of does. What I have been using is Dawn Power Wash. This is Dawn detergent, but it's in a spray bottle. And what's great about this is that you simply spray it on what you want to clean, and you don't use any more soap than you have to. You don't have to have a big soapy bowl of water or anything. You just take your things, spray them with this, use a sponge, rub them, and then rinse them, and you're done. It uses a little bit of water, a little bit of soap, and I think it's the most efficient way to do dishes in a van that I have seen right now. The problem is that you have to buy Dawn Power Wash refills, and they're expensive. But I have a recipe where you can make your own power wash refill using cheaper detergents. It turns out the secret of Dawn Power Wash is the ratio of soap to water and the addition of alcohol. There's a little bit of isopropanol in there. And you can just buy one Dawn Power Wash bottle, and then you can make your own refills using whatever kind of soap you want. And you'll have to test it to see if it works, you know. But it should work as long as it's anything similar to Dawn. Tales from the road. Oh, okay. So this tale. All right, I'm going to talk about the James Randi Educational Foundation again, because this came up in Discord. In the Discord channel, we've been having a very busy week talking in there. We've talked about a whole bunch of different things. And one of the things we talked about a lot was the JREF, the James Randi Education Foundation, where I used to work for James the Amazing Randi, a retired magician who was setting out to fix the world's wrongs, basically. He didn't like liars, and he was going to go and catch them out. Part of that was we had the $1 million challenge, which I talked about last week, which is basically that the organization would give you $1 million if you could prove any occult, paranormal, or supernatural ability under scientific observing conditions. Once, and only once, was I the subject of the challenge, meaning the challenge was being done to me. I wasn't the one who was going to get the millions, but I had to be involved. Now, normally, we didn't allow this because it would be easy for us to cheat, right? So we would try to have other people do the test, and we would just be out of it. That way, no one could accuse us of cheating because we weren't there. But the only way to set this test up was if a JREF employee was the one tested, and that was because of the nature of the challenge, which was a little strange. This woman approached us and said she had the power to control certain things about people. She could make them laugh. She could make them cry. She could do all these things, and she said her power came from God. It was a gift. There were certain things we couldn't test, and religious things were one. Is there a God or not? I can prove there's a God. No, we can't test that. That is not something that we can do under scientific observing conditions. What we can do is test a gift. We don't care where it came from, but if you can do something like this, then you can win. But how do you do this? I mean, laugh, cry, there's lots of ways that you could fake that. And then she said, I can also make people lose continence. And continence? Like, continence. Meaning, she could make people pee their pants. A very strange gift, to be sure, but one that we could test. So we designed a protocol where she would do her thing, which apparently was praying while she was staring at the person, and they would be powerless to not pee their pants. The problem with this is that you could cheat, right? If she had a compadre, they could just pee their pants. And they, you know, so we had to use somebody whose motivation was to have this person not win. Enter a JREF staff person. Enter me. Yeah. And this was in the early days of YouTube, and we said, what if we live stream it? Yeah, so we live streamed this on YouTube. The videos might still be out there. I wasn't able to find them. At the time, YouTube had a limit of 9 minutes, so we had to do this over two videos. But they're out there somewhere, I think. At any rate, what happened was, I had to first prove that the clothes I was wearing would make it obvious that I had lost continence. So I had a duplicate pair of jeans. I put one on, and I put a spray bottle down my pants and said, look, if I actually peed myself, this is what it looked like, okay? My pants showed a dark spot. Okay, so that's what we were looking for. Changed into dry pants and also went to the bathroom. So I started with an empty bladder. She said that would be fine because, and I quote, God will create the urine. Okay. And then for the next 15 minutes, I had a camera pointed at my crotch, which was live streamed on YouTube. And we had quite a few people watching. This wasn't like it is now, but we had 1,000 people watching, which is not nothing. And it's a little bit more attention than I thought my crotch would deserve on most days. But we went through the test. Rosemary worked at it and worked at it. And standing still for 15 minutes is something I find hard. So we asked her if it would be okay if I had a phone in my hand while we did this. And in my hand, I had the phone and I was answering questions in a chat room about this. Do you feel anything yet? Is anything going on? I would say, no, everything's fine, whatever. And then my girlfriend got on there at the time and started sending me messages, DMs, private messages. Some of these messages were a little bit suggestive. And I realized what she was trying to do. And you might realize what she was trying to do, given the proximity of the camera to my crotch. And fortunately, she was also unsuccessful. And yes, that is the end of the story there, folks. Rosemary was the name of the person who had these abilities. She was unsuccessful and completely baffled in the end. And my girlfriend, who I had some words with later, was also unsuccessful in creating an incident live on YouTube. Now, after the challenge was over, we went and talked with Rosemary and said, we're sorry, for whatever reason, your powers didn't work today. We gave her some books to read about the topic and sent her on her way. And we felt bad for Rosemary. Rosemary was definitely someone who believed she had these powers and just couldn't perform that day. But yeah, that's a thing that happened. You never know where you're going to find yourself. I think that's the moral of the story. You too may find yourself with a camera pointed at your crotch being live streamed on YouTube someday. Probably not, but it's not impossible. A place to visit. In Salem, Massachusetts, there's a museum called the PEM, the Peabody Essex Museum. It's a merger of a bunch of museums that were there when I was a kid. It's a fascinating place. It was started by sea captains who wanted to bring back all their cool stuff and display it in a cabinet of curiosities. It's much, much, much more than that now, and I actually miss the old museum somewhat. But this museum has a house in it, or just outside of it. It's an outdoor house from China, from the 18th century. This is a very cool thing, and it's the only thing like it that you can see in the United States that I'm aware of. It is called the Yin Yu Tang Chinese Home. And it's from the Qing Dynasty, and a prosperous merchant built this home. It's got 16 bedrooms, and the name translates to a few different things, but basically Hall of Plentiful Shelter. And the entirety of this home has been moved and recreated to Salem, Massachusetts, and you can get tickets and wander around it. And it is seeing a completely different way of life than Westerners are used to. There were as many as 30 people living in this house at one time. And what's striking about this house is that it doesn't have a roof. The house is built in a way like a castle, where the walls contain the rooms and the courtyard is open. Except it's not a courtyard, it's actually the inside of the house. And it has water flowing through it. It was built on the principles of feng shui, which we tested that at the JRF too. I'll set that aside. But and because of that, water brings in qi or chi or however you want to pronounce it, and you wanted that flowing through the center of your house and the direction of the house. All that stuff you will learn about if you go and visit this. But what's fascinating is that the time that they froze the house in isn't the 18th century, it's the 1950s. So you are going to go into a 200-year-old house frozen in the 1950s with the artwork and radios and calendars and all the stuff they had. They had electricity in it in the 1950s, but then knowing it was built in the 1700s. It's really a cool place to visit. It's perfectly replicated. There's nothing Disney about this. It is the actual, real, authentic thing. The only thing that's in there that isn't original are the signs explaining what's going on, and they are unobtrusive. You really can imagine yourself back in China in this home and seeing how people lived. And just a great cultural element. And it's actually kind of perfect for Salem, because Salem, witches, blah, blah, blah. But Salem had a huge impact on the culture of the United States, because it was at one time one of the largest seaports in the Americas and traded frequently with the Far East, including China. So a lot of Chinese culture came into the U.S. through Salem. So it makes a lot of sense to have this house here. Very cool place to visit. I've been a few times. It's a timed entry. Make sure you get tickets ahead of time. But wow, it's a great experience and something unique in America, I think. So again, it is called the Yin Yu Tang Home at the Peabody Essex Museum, right downtown in Salem. Very easy to find. And finally, real quick, because I'm going over, resource recommendation from T Tubbs, a Discord channel member. By the way, if you're looking for the Discord channel, it is called Built to Go, a Discord channel, and you can find the links at the top at builttogo.com. But T-Tubbs was very confused about all the numbers in solar, and despite us telling him, you don't have to worry about all the numbers, he wanted to understand this, and good for him. So he found a great website that explains all the numbers and has calculators for what you need. It is at footprinthero.com/solar-panel-series-and-parallel-calculator. There's a link in the show notes. Or if you go to footprinthero.com, you can probably find it. But it's basically a calculator. So you can figure out what your panels are doing, what panels you need. You enter in all the numbers, like, I need 300 watts of solar. How do I do that? And it will tell you what you need. It is very detailed. It is very complex. And in my opinion, it is overkill. But if you're somebody who really wants to get into the heart of solar and understand how it all works, this calculator will help you. Just be aware that you don't really need to get into this level of things. You don't need to know that your max system voltage is 600 volts DC, or that your fire rating is the irradiance of a standard 100-watt panel is 1,000 watts per meter squared with a temperature of 25 degrees C. You don't really need to know all that stuff. But if you want to, this is a great, great resource for it. And the one thing I can see this being really useful for is if you're worried about exceeding the amperage or voltage of your solar controller. That is a thing that can happen. If you get a 30-amp controller and then you double the size of your solar array, suddenly your solar panels are producing more than 30 amps, and you've got a problem. So, again, this is at footprinthero.com. You can find a link in the show notes. And thank you very much to T-Tubbs for letting us know about this. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to another episode of Built to Go. Van Life Podcast music, as always, is by Simon Wag. If you'd like to engage us on the social medias, the best two places are the Discord channel previously mentioned and on Facebook at, you guessed it, Built to Go, a Facebook group. Links for all of these are in the show notes. And until next time, remember the words of Mehmet Murat İlhan, who said, "Those who try to illuminate the world with a single candle quickly realize what a tremendous power the sun is."